This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Dr. Chloe Carmichael, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks, Germ. Thanks for having me.
Normally, we speak about free speech within the framework of politics. Your approach is psychological. It's mental.
Yeah. You know, I really hadn't planned to think about it this way either. As a clinical psychologist, I was focused a lot more on issues related to anxiety and more typical psychology stuff as a clinical psychologist. And then it was during COVID when cancel culture started getting on the rise, and I personally realized that there were some topics that I was doing what we call self-censorship about, and I ultimately decided I had to speak up about those issues out of an ethical duty. It had to do with masking children. And when I started speaking up, I realized that my cognitive process, you know, was sharpening, and emotional regulation, that I was feeling less stressed and edgy about the issues once I started talking about them. And it suddenly hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, well, of course. I mean, psychologists, if you remove the phrase free speech and you just say to psychologists, would talking about what you think and feel be good for you? Would it help you on a cognitive level? Would it help you on an emotional level? Would it improve your social relationships? They'll all say, of course. But if you say, well, would free speech be good for mental health? You know, then suddenly, because the issue is politically coded and my profession skews in a certain direction, all of a sudden it's controversial.
Just quickly, what is your background?
Oh, sure. I'm a clinical psychologist. Is that what you mean? Like my professional background? Mm. Yeah. So I was actually a yoga teacher before I was a clinical psychologist. And so as a yoga teacher, I focused a lot on metacognition, which is your awareness of yourself. I think that's why I had that reflective process about what it meant to speak up. And then I went to Columbia for not a doctorate. I got my undergraduate in psychology at Columbia. Then I went on to get a PhD in clinical psychology and started my practice in New York City. My very first book was a self-published book about dating, actually, with high-functioning people. And then my next book was Nervous Energy, Harness the Power of Your Anxiety. It's about the healthy function of anxiety, which is to stimulate preparation behaviors. And then my new book is Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. And I know you've connected with RFKJ before, so I just have to say my publisher is the same publisher as RFKJ's, Skyhorse.
Great publisher. They also published Alex Jones, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, well,
His book on The Great Reset.
And I was so thankful for Skyhorse to take this book, because even though my Nervous Energy book was a success, it was with Macmillan, they refused to take this book. They said that they would like to do another book with me, just not this book. Again, it's so weird to me that a book simply about the mental health benefits of speaking your mind could be so controversial, right?
What are the mental health benefits?
Well, so I have to admit, it's going to sound really obvious when I tell you, right? I mean, it's really intuitive, but yet, of course, there's a million studies and whatnot to back it up and take it apart and understand it, you know, deeper, which I do put in the book. But there's three main psychological benefits, mental health benefits to free speech. And then there are also, on the flip side, some drawbacks to self-censorship. But the benefits are cognitive. So when we use our incredible gift of language, It facilitates, for example, the use of logic to be able to make if-then statements or to be able to create a hypothesis or to rapidly exchange information with other people. Also, when we speak our ideas aloud, it helps us to have a separation from our ideas and to be more rational and objective about them. We don't think about language. It's almost like breathing. It's something that feels so natural to us, but yet it's really actually very important to our functioning. And then the emotional benefits of language. When we, even something as simple as naming your emotions, if you're really upset and you just say nothing, it bottles inside of you. But if the moment you start saying, you know what, I'm really upset by this, or I found that situation embarrassing, or I felt violated by that, your amygdala starts to calm down. The amygdala is the part of the brain that gets really active during fear. Also, our cortisol levels drop when we have a good heart-to-heart with somebody, when we express ourselves. And so the three benefits, I've discussed cognitive and emotional, and they facilitate the social benefits, social support. So as a clinical psychologist, I have to assess somebody's social support as part of any comprehensive evaluation. Social support is so incredibly crucial to our mental health. It's an incredible buffer against stressors that helps us to navigate problems when we have a support network. But if we're not telling people the truth about what we really think and feel, or even worse, like actually pretending to think and feel things that we don't because it's politically correct, or they're doing the same thing, of course, our social support is degraded.
Yeah, you said truth, and so is lying a form of censorship?
Well, sure. I mean, absolutely. It's pantomiming, whatever is a politically correct, moment. So, for example, if, you put your pronouns on your bio because your boss tells you to or whatever, even though you think that is ridiculous and it's obvious. And, by doing that, you're acting as if you believe it's necessary to tell people or something. Or laughing at jokes that you don't think are funny because you don't want to be outed as, in the U.S., it would basically oftentimes be Trump. And it does typically run left to right more than left to right. And I can get into some interesting statistics about that, too. But I've talked to many people that have been in situations where somebody wants to do an Orange Man bad joke and they feel like they have to laugh at the joke and act like they think it's funny. Otherwise, somebody might, wonder, well, are you a Trumpy or whatever? So, yeah, I mean, lying, of course, I would say it's a really elaborate form of self-censorship. It's going beyond just simply not saying anything and taking active steps to portray something inaccurate about what you think and feel and believe.
Let's go back to the basics. When you talk about free speech, Chloe, what are you talking about?
That's a great question. And I get into this in the book too. It can mean two things. There's free speech in the legal sense, which absolutely in the United States got subverted under the Biden administration. We now know that executives at YouTube, Meta, and X have all indicated that the government was behind the scenes, interfering with freedom of expression on those platforms. So free speech can be a legal issue, which we also saw with parents here going to school board meetings, trying to talk about that they didn't want boys in the girls' locker room or they didn't want their kids wearing masks. And, the government was putting FBI tails on those people. And then there's another kind of free speech, which I use in a more the colloquial term, but which is actually very important, too, which is self-censorship, where the government's not even censoring you. You're censoring yourself because you are afraid of, being socially ostracized, dropped from your friend group, failed by your college professor, called into your HR department and kind of blacklisted for promotions. There's a lot of soft power ways that people can feel pressure to self-censor that aren't necessarily in the legal realm.
Okay, but that's still a fairly safe answer. free speech, by definition, means free, so no limits.
Yeah, I mean, so that's actually an interesting question, too. So there's a chapter in the book called Common Objections to Free Speech, and one of them is, what about some kind of limits on free speech? And yes, you know, anxiety is always worse in the face of uncertainty. So I do take a moment in the book to unpack, like, what are the limits? Like, even I consider myself a free speech absolutist. However, I still consider that to include the basic limits we have, like fraud, libel, slander. I don't think it's okay to use your speech to say, you know, go execute that person. Ha ha, free speech, you know. So things that are already illegal doesn't mean that that's just because they're spoken, they magically become legal. Free speech to me, being a free speech absolutist, applies to the expression of ideas, thoughts, and beliefs.
Okay, so you're suggesting that it's good to be able to have the ability to speak freely, but you should also be a decent human being. I mean, you're not going to run past an old granny on a bus and start swearing at her for no reason. Well, other than the fact that you got free speech.
No, no. So I also discuss in the book the difference between healthy self-restraint and self-censorship. So yeah, I mean, we would already have laws about, you know, obscenity, for example, you know, or harassment. So we also have something in the United States called a time, place, and manner restriction. So for example, you're allowed to go, and I would support somebody's right. If they want to go around saying women are stupid, fine. Like, they have a legal right to say that. However, if you want to get a public permit to get a loudspeaker and shout that outside of a Girl Scouts meeting, you can be denied that under a time, place, and manner restriction. But that's different from saying we take away your right to generally express that idea. So, you know, to your point, also there's healthy self-restraint. I don't support the idea of people having no filter. So, you know, if somebody says, like, hey, do I look good in this dress, or, you know, whatever, like, there might be times where you say, like, yeah, you know what, it really brings out your eyes, but you don't say, you know, but it makes you, you know, look
fat.
Yeah, whatever the case may be. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have tact. I mean, in fact, there's in the techniques portion of the book, there's a lot of techniques for learning how to listen well, how to express yourself well. And in fact, my argument partly is that the more we bottle things up, the more likely we are to actually be inappropriately edgy or aggressive, because stuff kind of comes out that we've been bottling. But however, even though I advocate for healthy self-restraint, I don't think that's a legal requirement that people should feel subjected to.
Just for clarity, also on this idea of free speech, free expression, like a pride rally where men wear no clothes and there are kids around, and I tend to find that fairly repulsive.
Yeah, so you're getting at something really important, and I unpack this in the book a little bit too, which is that in the United States around the 1970s, pornography got included in freedom of, quote, expression. In our United States Constitution, we have protection on freedom of speech. So I'm talking about spoken ideas. Freedom of, quote, expression through, you know, appearing in public nude, that would not be, in my opinion, covered if I, you know, wrote the world. That would not be covered under freedom of speech, because that's not a spoken act. So yeah, I mean, I think we still do have public decency laws against appearing nude in public. And depending on where you live here in the United States, there may or may not be local ordinances around those.
So in your book, you talk about self-censorship being a problem. Why?
Well, so 84%, I mean, and I realize statistics are just, you know, statistics, but 84% of people in a 2022 poll by the New York Times, which, you know, typically would not be a friend of free speech, but a poll even coming from the New York Times and Siena College found that 84% of Americans are holding things back because they're afraid on some level of being of cancel culture. So, I mean, I see it in those types of statistics. I see it in people and clients that I've talked to in private. I've even seen it in myself. Like I said, I went through my own, you know, free speech journey. I think that many of us just kind of thought, oh, well, it's safer to just be quiet. Why stick my neck out? And I did that myself a lot until I had a real, like, kind of red line in the sand when it came to masking children. And then once I started speaking up, I suddenly realized that there was, and again, it seems so obvious in retrospect, but that there's a real cost to self-censorship. I mean, you and your audience, I'm sure everybody kind of these days knows the words like repression, suppression, denial. Those are mental health costs of keeping things inside. So I think that we got here by people thinking the safe thing to do is to just hold back. Well, like, what's the harm in that? Without realizing that there's a mental health reason to speak up. And we also got here by what I mentioned earlier of the Biden administration and probably other governments too. I don't know as much about outside of the US, but when the Biden administration was secretly tampering with what could be said and expressed on social media, what they did is they manipulated our human sense of social consensus. So we all have an adaptive ability to understand, you know, to just read the room, right? And so if you go into a room and everybody's saying, you know, the emperor's new clothes are beautiful, right? And you think you're the only person that realizes that emperor has no clothes, you might not speak up because you might say to yourself, am I seeing double? Is this just me? And so that's called social consensus. And the Biden administration really interfered with our sense of social consensus by secretly manipulating what was able to be viewed and seen on basically all of our social media platforms.
But that spread beyond the US. I mean, everybody in the world uses Facebook, for example, and that affected even me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it did. So, you know, through those ways, that's, you know, to answer your question, why and how I think it came to be that so many people, you know, were self-censoring. I think in part, it's just that they didn't, including me, even really realize the costs of it. And then we had a falsely manipulated social atmosphere of what we thought was the new normal.
And as you say in your book, if more and more people are self-censoring, it leads to a reduction in information flow.
Yeah, totally it does. You know, which is, again, one of the common objections to free speech in that chapter is, well, what about misinformation, right? Which is so ironic that people would think, and I try to give people the benefit of the doubt that the speech police are truly concerned about misinformation and somehow this, you know, in a convoluted manner came out to their minds that therefore what we should do is suppress, you know, speech and debate, when the opposite, of course, is true. If we want to have a high quality of information, we need to be able to have a free flow of information and allow people to debate and debunk. I mean, for example, did you know that the physician who originally suggested that physicians should wash their hands at hospitals before seeing patients, he died in a mental institution because in his time, people told him that he was crazy. Galileo, of course, was jailed for saying that the earth orbits the sun. In the United States, we had physicians testifying to Congress that it was fine for pregnant women to smoke cigarettes as long as they used a filter. More recently, of course, we had, you know, Fauci telling us that we needed to stay 6 feet apart and, you know, wear masks and that this would somehow be good for us. So experts can, of course, be wrong. It would be unfair to experts to expect them to never be wrong. But how would we ever, I mean, this sounds so obvious, but how would we ever get past the misinformation if we don't allow people to come forward and discuss and debate ideas?
The last few years, we've had a huge amount of censorship coming from above, and then as a result, self-censorship coming from the bottom. And that has led to us having to have conversations like this that are profoundly primitive and basic, and we shouldn't be even talking about this in the year 2025.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it kind of reminds me of when you have an abuser with a victim, and, you know, the victim has been very isolated and has almost gotten a warped sense of reality from her abuser. I'm just, you know, saying her and him just for stereotypes, but she's gotten a warped sense of reality because she hasn't been able to talk and to speak. And when she's coming out of that abusive dynamic, she needs to tell very basic stories like, well, he dragged me by my hair and that was wrong. And just by saying it aloud, she's really coming to grips with what actually happened. And like you said, it sounds very obvious. Or when somebody dies, one of the first stages of grief is denial. And that's why people who are trying to come out of that denial phase, they need to just say the obvious many times, like, wow, I guess he's gone. He's not coming back, right? And they're obvious things, but it's through speech, through saying them aloud, that they come out of that, they come to that basic awareness. And to your point, yes, our basic awareness about what it's okay to say and if it should be okay to say what we want and what's really going on in the world around us, all of that has been distorted. And so, yes, we need to have some of these basic wake-up conversations.
But Chloe, words are violence.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Words are violence, right? That's one of those catchphrases that, you know, sounds, you know, almost poetic, right? It's fine, you know, if people realize it's just a metaphor, right? Like, oh, his words were like a slap in the face. His words were a punch in the gut, right? That's fine as a metaphor. But the problem is that people are, they're taking it literally, which is psychotic. That's where we cross the line from using language in a, you know, poetic way to actually becoming psychotic. Psychotic in psychology means a break with reality, like, you know, little green men, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, many people are taking that phrase, words are violence, or what, you're threatening my existence. If somebody says that, you know, that they're a man who has now become a woman, and somebody says, no, you're not. And then they say, well, you know, you're threatening my existence. And they mean it literally. And then what is happening is then they're opening up a line for actual violence in quote, self-defense. So humans have a very hardwired, innate, and actually productive need for reciprocity. And that can be in trade, like you give me something, I give you something. That's also hardwired into our justice code, even going back to the Code of Hammurabi, right? But when somebody then distorts that with violence and says, well, your words are violence or your words are threatening my existence, what they're doing is they're setting up a reciprocity that makes it okay for Tyler Robinson, for example, allegedly to go shoot Charlie Kirk because Charlie Kirk's words were violence. Charlie Kirk was, you know, a threatening existence. And so therefore he needs to pick up a gun and literally take his life. Words can only lead to violence if they are words that are already outlawed, like, hey, I want to pay you X dollars to go murder that person, right? That's a situation of words, you know, leading to violence. Otherwise, anything other than that, like, well, I don't like what you say, so therefore I'm going to become violent. Again, that's classic abuse dynamics, right? You made me do it because you started your bitching again. So I had to go beat the hell out of you, right? That's classic abuser rationale to say, well, you know, I had to become violent because of what you said in terms of expressing your thoughts and feelings and ideas. That's nonsense.
Wouldn't you prefer to know somebody wants to shoot you than if you don't know that they want to shoot you?
Yeah, of course. And again, wanting to is one thing. And that's why, again, I go in the book and explore this, quote, concept of safe spaces, right? That a truly safe space is one where we can withstand disagreement and where people know what other people really think again. So I, as a woman, if somebody thinks, you know, that you know, women are stupid or whatever it is, I feel better knowing what they really think than knowing I'm actually in some weird space where I can't trust what people say because I know that they have to keep it all underneath them. And sure, so if somebody wants to go around saying that they believe, you know, X group of people should be eradicated, I actually count that as free speech. They're making an argument and a belief. The difference is when they cross the line into speech that's actually action-oriented, like, hey, let's all meet up at 5 o'clock today with our billy clubs and go attack those people. That is different from expressing an idea. That's using your speech to organize a violent action.
I just want to add as a segue, I actually believe that women on average are smarter than men.
Well, you know, do you know what the statistics say about that?
No.
It's an interesting bell curve situation. And Larry Summers actually basically got ejected as the president of Harvard for
saying
this.
I think I saw that. Sorry, go on. Yes.
So the simple fact is that men and women, if you average our intelligence scores, they're pretty much the same. But there's many, many, many more women in the average zone. And there's many, many, many more men in the genius zone. And there's many, many more men in the very low intelligence zone. So there's a lot more male geniuses. There's also a lot more male idiots. And there's just a lot of women that are in the middle.
But that's, my wife and I were talking about this. This is precisely why I find Jackass very funny and she doesn't.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So you said earlier that open dialogue enhances a good mental health status. In other words, it reduces levels of anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, psychologists, again, would typically just know this in a very obvious sense. It's really what talk therapy hinges upon, right? Is the idea that, you know, you can come into the therapy room and then the therapist might even probe you and help you to take, you know, your unconscious ideas. The unconscious is pre-verbal. And so you might have some beliefs and thoughts and ideas that are operating in the background of your mind. That are causing you anxiety, right? You know, maybe you have a background unconscious belief that you picked up in childhood that it's not safe to be open with people or something. And so therefore, then you have this problem in life because you're craving intimacy, but yet you're just holding yourself back and you can't figure it out. So the psychologist will probe your unconscious beliefs and help you to put them into words and understand why it's been so anxiety provoking for you to get close to people by taking what's going on inside and putting it into words. The healthy function of anxiety is to stimulate preparation behaviors. And we know that through talking is a problem-solving tool. Many studies have shown, and again, it's obvious, but of course, in psychology, sometimes we need to do studies to check if what we think is obvious is really true. But talking with another person who's an intelligent and supportive sounding board does help people to solve problems. So again, the healthy function of anxiety is to stimulate preparation behaviors. So obviously talking with somebody about your problems can help to alleviate your anxiety by it becomes a preparation behavior. Also, one of the hallmark symptoms of depression is a sense of helplessness. This is why anxiety can sometimes lead to depression, because you're stewing in that anxiety. And if you don't know how to channel that into preparation and problem-solving behaviors, you can start to feel helpless and become depressed, right? And so one of the symptoms, you know, as I said, of depression is a sense of helplessness. So we can see where talking things through would alleviate a sense of helplessness. Also, one of the symptoms of depression is a sense of isolation and irritability and lethargy and not connecting with others. So again, obviously, having a good social relationships with people would help. When we have a true heart-to-heart with people, when you're telling me what you really think and I'm really listening, we experience what psychologists call neural coupling, brain coupling. Our brains, it's like that old saying, we were on the same wavelength. Our brains literally start to show similar neural patterns together. And we need this on an evolutionary tribal level. We need to feel that sense of connection, or we struggle mentally and with our mental health.
When I talk to my wife, she certainly doesn't have any type of self-censorship issues. But, jokes aside, is there a difference between men and women and the levels of self-censorship?
You know, that's a great question. To be honest, I don't know. But I would like to take a moment and differentiate between self-censorship and healthy self-restraint. Because I know you were just joking, but it's a good thing in a marriage, typically, that you can be real and honest with each other. If she makes a meal and says, what do you think? Shall I make this again? And you smile and say, yeah, it was great, right? That's going to cause a real problem. But if you can tell the truth and say, you know, honey, I appreciate it, but honestly, it's a little spicy for me or whatever. It's better to tell the truth. But self-censorship is when we're being untruthful about true, actual, real values that matter to us. So, you know, if your wife or somebody else is out with their friends and somebody says, yeah, you know, I just don't see why these heartless people are against immigration. Anybody with an open heart should allow, you know, anybody to come into our country. And if you don't agree with that, but you pretend to, that's a real issue of values. On the other hand, if you're just out with your friends and somebody says, you know, boy, that sports team, you know, really is my favorite, and you're out wining and dining some clients and you say, yeah, they're having a great season, right? That's maybe just healthy self-restraint. You're not really lying about anything that is important to you. But within a marriage, it's an interesting one because we do need some self-restraint to have a good marriage, but we also want to be extra open to have a good marriage. And we certainly don't want to have self-censorship. We don't want to be lying about our values in a good marriage.
Let's say that you find out that your close friend was cheated on.
Yeah. So first of all, that's a great moral quandary. Whichever way a person decided about that, I think there's probably various factors and whatnot. I'm not going to make a pronouncement on whether they should say something or not. But that would fall into the self-restraint category. And to understand a really good rule of thumb test to just make it super easy to understand the difference is, do you know where the word censor comes from? So it comes from back in the Roman days, they had these special soldiers that were actually called censors. And they would go ride around to the villages that were all controlled, you know, by the Romans. And they would inform the citizenry what viewpoints and politics and morals and religion or whatever else were acceptable to say and do and practice, right? And so when you start feeling like, you know, you have a viewpoint or an idea that you want to say or express, but like that little Roman censor could get on your case about it, that's when we're dealing with self-censorship. Levels of self-restraint, if you choose to disclose that someone's having an affair or not, just out of your own personal decisions about what your role is in disclosure there, that's about your own personal level of self-restraint that you choose. And that's on that particular moral one, I could see where, you know, people could make arguments on both sides, but it's not really about censorship.
I didn't know that about the Romans. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And it I like it too, because it really does explain that it's something that's happening on some level by force, right? And then it's to the point where if you did start violating what those Roman censors said, your neighbors could turn you in. They could go tell on you for saying that, right? So if you're wondering if it's a matter of self-restraint or self-censorship, just ask yourself, is this the kind of thing like a Roman soldier would have gone around to inform the general public about? Or is this just a personal matter in my life that I'm trying to decide if I should speak up about the affair or not?
So free speech being a mental issue cuts right through the left-right dichotomy.
Well, that's true, but I do. You're kind of dancing on the left-right issue. So, I think it's just important to acknowledge the truth, because when people are thinking, okay, well, I'm going to break through self-censorship and I'm going to start speaking up, they're a lot more likely to encounter problems and difficulties if you are on the more conservative side and you're speaking up to a supposedly more liberal group than the reverse. And that's kind of counterintuitive, right? We would normally think, well, liberal would have a wider window of what can be said. But in my book, I explain something called the 5 Ds. And the 5 Ds are forms of social hostility that are done by self-report much more often by people on the left over political differences than by people on the right. And the 5 Ds are to defriend on social media, to drop contact in real life, to distance in real life, to disinvite a speaker, or to decline to date across the aisle. Now, I actually can understand the decline to date across the aisle, because if you're dating for marriage and you want to marry somebody that has your values, I actually can understand that one. But all of the other Ds, I think are really unnecessary forms of social hostility that are significantly, and I can tell you the link. It's at drchloe.com/5, the letter D, the letter S, and I can give you a link for your show notes. But I put links to all of the scholarly research about the 5 Ds, right there. So to your point, if you're thinking of speaking up and you're feeling like, well, it's harder to do it as if you're on a more conservative side expressing it to liberals, you are correct. It's really true. And what's interesting as well is that people who identify as liberal are also 2 to 8 times more likely to endorse political violence. And as a psychologist, I think there's a real connection there, because if I'm working with a violent offender, the first thing I want to do is get them to use their words, is to learn how to have dialogue with people during disagreements. Violence increases when dialogue ceases. So, it's interesting to me that the political left displays more social hostility of with what I call dialogue intolerance. And now they're also showing a greater tendency towards political violence. I think those things are related.
And that wasn't always the case. If I look at American history, I think that flipped at some point in history. It was the other way around.
Yes, I discuss that in the book too, which is to say that this doesn't have to be like some kind of a permanent issue in our political DNA. So, as I mentioned, it was in the 1970s that liberals were pushing for pornography to be included within freedom of expression, and conservatives were resistant. Also, liberals were pushing for wider windows on obscenity, and conservatives were trying to put explicit warning labels on, rap CDs. However, I do think it's important to notice this is just kind of an undisputed, uncontroversial psychology fact. This has been existent for a long time. People on the left have a more collectivist mentality. People on the right have a more individualist mentality. So, to a certain degree, I think it makes sense that when it comes to the expression of ideas and beliefs, people on the right are very open. But when it comes to, pornography or obscenity, they're more closed off to that. And then on the left, having this more collectivist mentality, that maybe that contributes to them feeling more of a desire to be in lockstep when it comes to beliefs and values.
If you had asked me 10 years ago if I was going to get a flu shot, I might have said no. And we there wouldn't have been any kind of weirdness between us.
Yeah. Yeah, I would put that in. That's an interesting one. You could make an argument on self-censorship or self-restraint there, right? Because if you also say, had a friend that weighed 500 pounds and he was talking about another friend that weighed 500 pounds that died of a heart attack, your self-restraint might keep you from saying, you know, gee, I guess I really, it's probably his weight, right? You would just be trying to avoid, you know, hurting his feelings or bringing up an awkward topic, right? So the same thing could be said maybe about the booster shot thing. The difference, though, is that there's been this extreme social taboo placed on open dialogue about booster shots. And people might do more than just get ruffled on a personal level. They might become enraged at you on a values or political level. They might, it might be more than just, gee, that was insensitive. It might be more like, you know, what's the matter with you for bringing up that misinformation and that conspiracy theory? That's more on the self-censorship side.
A lot of this conversation about free speech, though, is centered around culture, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, with the self-censorship, there are many cultures that are openly embracing censorship, right? Like, I don't think in China that I don't know, but I don't think, or many Middle Eastern countries, they don't even pretend to say that they welcome people to express whatever ideas and values that they have. They're very open about the fact that they have some form of those Roman censors, you know, still riding around telling people, you know, what it's okay to say. So, yeah, you're right. There are many cultures where censorship is still alive and well from a top-down, you know, government form. And then there's many places where, again, just that non-governmental but social pressure, which can often be delivered through the media as well, which is just another, you know, situation where I think in many cases, people here in the United States are concerned that the media, and we learned this too, in fact, to be true in some cases, was getting their talking points from the government, or that you have a media group that's pretending to be unbiased, but it's, you know, donating massively to a particular political party, in which case it's not really media, it's propaganda, right? So, yeah, but you're right. There's different cultural mores and social norms. You know, in some cultures, of course, it would be a compliment to say, hey, you're looking really fat today, right? You know, and so what would be self-restraint in one culture might be different in another. But you're right, self-censorship differs across cultures too. Again, it's so ironic to me because intergroup dialogue is actually the way, obviously, that we come to understand each other and to, you know, be able to have tolerance for each other, to be able to work out our differences together. And it's when we shut down dialogue that we end up having, you know, bigger social silos and, you know, misunderstandings about each other. But even groups, you know, that I think we can just all objectively agree are, quote, bad. So I give some examples in the book about the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, or, you know, jihadi recruiters. These are groups that I hope we can all agree are just objectively, you know, bad. However, the way that people come out of those cults, if you will, is not by people saying you're not allowed to talk. It's by people having dialogue with them. Now, that's different. I'm not saying that they should be allowed to go and use their speech to say, let's meet up at 5 p.m. and lynch somebody today. But I do think that they should be allowed to say, I believe that this certain racial group is inferior, and here's why. So that way somebody else can dialogue with them and reason with them, or even just know how they really feel and choose to stay away from them or whatever. But cutting out people's tongues is one of the most primitive and ineffective ways. It's like not opening your credit card bills and thinking it means that you have no debt, right? Mm-hmm. Just silencing people, it really, truly doesn't solve anything.
To feed into what you're saying, I don't know if you've heard of a black blues or jazz musician by the name of Daryl Davis.
He's in my book.
Yes. And he spent years and years and years befriending members of the KKK. And instead of shouting at them and telling them to be quiet, he actually tried to understand them. And through that, a bunch of them left the KKK.
Exactly. He has a very powerful TED Talk where he displays dozens of KKK hoods that have been surrendered to him. My understanding is now he actually also has a book out, so maybe you could get him on your show. So, you know, we're getting into part two of the book now, which is the techniques. So part one is the psychological benefits and costs of speaking up or not. And then part two is techniques for speaking up courageously when it's hard to do that, as well as for listening well when people are seeing things that you disagree with, because obviously we need both in order to have healthy dialogue. And it's just so many interesting things I learned as I was researching this. For example, did you know that when our heart rate goes above 100 beats per minute, we are not cognitively processing information as well as when we're calm and relaxed, which makes perfect sense, right? And so then when two people are in a heated political disagreement, you know, they're cutting each other off, they're having stereotypes about each other, they're talking past each other. So one of the things, you know, to your point about listening to understand, I bring up actually a couples therapy technique in the book called reflective listening, where, you know, person A says their piece, person B, their whole job at first is just to repeat back. So person A, you believe A, B, and C because X, Y, and Z. Is that right? And then when person B knows that their job is going to be to recap person A, they become a much better listener because they want to do well at that little task. They want to show that they really heard and understood. And then person A is going to be a lot calmer when they're speaking because they're not thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to get cut off or I better try to get my point in quickly. They get to relax and become more peaceful. And then the tables turn after the good, successful recap. Then person B says their piece and person A recaps it. And that restores some order and dialogue and some structure. And it gets around this whole problem of people not understanding each other. You'd be surprised when that exercise is done how often person B gets it wrong the first time. And it's really illuminating when people can stop arguing over things that nobody even actually ever said. When they can get slowed down, it's very helpful.
But Chloe, all that matters is winning.
Well, I guess we have to reframe winning, right? I mean, well, you know, I mean, we've seen this terrible thing now, right? Of going no contact and, you know, all those 5Ds that I talked about. And I think people on the left are doing those 5Ds because they really believe people on the right are fascists and Hitler and xenophobic and all these other things. And, you know, I know it's somewhat naive, but my hope is that if they could slow down and really hear what the other person is saying, they might come to revise their perceptions.
So what is your opinion then on your president, Donald Trump, making headlines recently for calling reporters fat and ugly and whatever else?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a perfect world, obviously, that wouldn't be happening. However, I get a lot more concerned about people hurling labels like Hitler, fascist, you know, celebrating violent deaths of, you know, people like Charlie Kirk, for example, or I find those labels, you know, white supremacist, Nazi, I see those labels being used by public figures, you know, comparing our immigration department to the Gestapo. I find those on a scale of 1 to 10 a lot worse than, you know, schoolyard insults. I don't like the schoolyard insults, but I find the Hitler, Nazi, fascist, white supremacist labels, when they're not accurate, I find those much more concerning.
I mean, what you're talking about is applicable in all spheres of life, not just politics.
Thank you. Yeah, that's my hope. And I tried to write the book honestly in a way that would be palatable to both the left and the right. In fact, because the left tends to be a lot more open and interested in mental health, they want to think of themselves as champions of mental health. And that's why a lot of times they want to shut down free speech because of concerns about hate speech and bullying, right? And so my hope was to say, like, hey, like, let's reframe free speech as a mental health issue. And maybe then it would be open, you know, to people across the aisle more. And like you said, you know, this transcends politics. This is freedom of expression, true freedom of expression and authenticity is something that can help us in our lives personally, professionally, academically. It helps us across the board.
If you argue for free speech, and you said earlier that you kind of are almost a free speech absolutist, does hate speech therefore exist?
Well, I mean, there's speech that is hateful, yes. I mean, and frankly, there are certain things it's fine to hate, right? I hate child sex rings, right? I hate the idea of people participating in those types of things. I don't even think that it's practical to try to tell people what it's okay to hate or that we should never hate anything. I mean, ironically, what do we hate then? You know, like we could go round and round forever with that. And I'm not saying that I, you know, agree or accept all speech. And I also am not saying that we should have no filter about what we say or that we have to lend our ears to everybody. So as a free speech absolutist, that doesn't mean that I don't have the right to discern, you know, what I will put into my media diet. But I just think when we start trying to categorize, well, it's what you're saying is hateful and therefore it's not allowed. But what you're saying is, you know, just a reasoned objection and therefore it is allowed. I mean, who's going to be the arbiter of that at the end of the day? So therefore, I think it's best to just have a very, very simple objective guideline, which is applicable to everybody, which is, you know, fraud, libel, slander, incitement to violence in the sense of semantically, syntactically, organizing actual physical violence. Like for me as a clinical psychologist, if somebody tells me in private that they're going to go say something mean and nasty to their neighbor, I am not allowed to break that confidence. If somebody tells me in a session that they're going to go beat the daylights out of their neighbor, I'm legally obligated to tell somebody. The difference is obvious. It's, you know, physical violence. So I think we're good with our very basic First Amendment rights as we have them in the United States. And hate speech is not banned by the First Amendment because it would be such an obvious and subjective way for people to come up with their values, right? I mean, somebody could say, well, speaking against Jesus Christ and saying, and I'm wearing a cross around my neck, right? But if somebody wanted to say, you know, bad things about Jesus Christ, I could say, well, that's hateful. And so therefore, you're not allowed to say it. I mean, but no, I support people's right to say their own thoughts and beliefs and ideas.
What about the government?
Sure. Well, I mean, again, so we have non-disclosure agreements, right? So you can voluntarily enter into an employment relationship, which is what, you know, if you're working for the CIA or the FBI or, you know, you're working for a science company and you agree that you're not going to disclose their proprietary formulas and recipes, right? That's not really a free speech issue because nobody's forcing you to enter into that agreement. You're choosing that in exchange for monetary compensation, you will keep certain information private that's important to that company or agency. So I don't really see that as a free speech violation because it's not being forced on anybody.
I'm thinking of people like, what was his name now? Was it Julian Assange? No. Mm-hmm. I've gone blank.
Oh, yeah. WikiLeaks. Snowden?
Yes.
So Assange was WikiLeaks and then Snowden was an NSA whistleblower type thing.
That's right.
So I think a whistleblower, you know, might be violating their non-disclosure agreement, But, you know, if they're doing it because the government or whatever body they're working for is actually breaking the law, and so the whistleblower has to step out of their legal agreement to alert the public about, you know, a real safety issue or concern because somebody else is breaking the law, I think that's why we have whistleblower protections, because those are unusual situations.
What's the moral of the story?
The moral of the story is that free speech is good for mental health. Very simple. You know, so when people try to shut down your free speech because of, quote, hate speech or bullying or misinformation or, you know, whatever the case may be, you know, I want people to have a way to answer back and say, well, actually, there's a lot of cognitive, emotional, and social benefits to freedom of expression. And, you know, that it would be good for us to be able to be authentic and to learn how to tolerate disagreement and to respect one another, and then to have some very, very practical tools on how to do that. So I wrote the book more as a public service announcement than anything else.
And how can my audience get your book?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking. They can go to freespeechtoday.com. So the book is available wherever books are sold. And I know your audience is overseas. So I'm curious if anybody has any trouble getting the book overseas, please do go to freespeechtoday.com. Well, Amazon definitely carries it. But if anybody has any problems, they can go to freespeechtoday.com, because that's where I also have Amazon links, because the book is kind of a mouthful of a title. It's Can I Say That? Why Free Speech Matters and How to Use It Fearlessly. But at my website, freespeechtoday.com, they can get the links. But also, if you have any trouble getting it wherever you're located, message me through my website and I'll get on it.
Chloe Carmichael, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much, Jerm. It's great to be in the trenches with you.